Good morning. Call the Property Tax and Local Sales Tax Division to order at 8:20, and we do have a quorum, so we'll proceed here and take up the minutes. We got a member that has looked them over. Representative Barrett.
Madam Chair, thank you. I've looked at the minutes, and they're good minutes, so because they're good minutes, I'd like to move to approve them.
Thanks for your motion. Any discussion? If not, the minutes are approved. No, I'm sorry. All approved, say aye.
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 And opposed, aye. Same sign. Okay, minutes are approved. And members, we do have a couple of bills we want to cover today. The first one, Green Acres, is a repeat of last week. It's a continuation, actually. And so we want to amendment that was passed is in your packet. We have several other amendments, and we are going to take testimony from county assessors and the revenue department. There were some questions in the last meeting, so we'll hear from those entities. We'll hear from those guys first. And also, I think, you know, we had a lot of discussion in the last meeting. Hopefully, we won't rehash some of those same ideas, and we can move on and cover the amendments and get the bill passed. So, Representative Lemire, do you want to bring your witnesses forward?
This is Mr. Hagan from the Department of Revenue, and Mrs. Pinky from the Minnesota Association of Assessing Officers.
Fine. Do you want to state your name, sir, and who you represent?
Good morning. My name is John Hagan. I'm the director of the Property Tax Division for the Minnesota Department of Revenue. And first of all, thank you for the opportunity to appear before the committee. I'm here this morning to speak in favor of House File 12. And I'd like to thank especially Representative Lemire for his willingness to work with property tax administrators and assessors and trying to resolve some of the administrative issues that we identified and his willingness to make this bill workable from our perspective. As I'm likely you all know, there was a great deal of misconceptions that resulted in a lot of controversy and a lot of pushback resulting from the Green Acres changes in 2008 and 2009. The result of this controversy was that there was a lot of talk about repealing the Green Acres law back to before the 2008 and 2009 changes to the existing Green Acres law. As a property administrator, my primary concern coming into this session was that we not repeal the Green Acres law back to the pre-2008 changes, because that would be a great expansion of Green Acres, and we'd be back in exactly the same mess we were in before the legislative auditor's report and before the legislation, the corrective legislation in 2008 and then the amending legislation in 2009. So my concern was to not expand it and also to leave 2A and 2B intact, which I think are critical to the quality of assessment in the state of Minnesota. And I believe eroding the 2A and 2B determination would be a great mistake for property tax administrators and the equity of the tax. In summation, I believe that removing the covenant and removing the assessment plan, which was fraught with a lot of problems, it was difficult in some counties to get the assessment plan, and some counties were unwilling or unable to, the soil and water conservation districts were unwilling or unable to provide an assessment plan, or a conservation plan as was known. I think that removing the covenant requirement and the plan requirement will make the rural preserve more attractive to farmers, eliminate a lot of the pushback, and will allow us to go forward in an orderly process with rural preserve without greatly undermining the existing legislation. So I am very much in support of this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hagan. And please state your name and who you represent for the record.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members. Thank you. My name is Gloria Pinky. I'm a manager in Dakota County Assessor's Office, but I'm here today on behalf of the Minnesota Association of Assessing Officers. And I want to basically echo what Mr. Hagan from the department has said. The assessors also are very, very happy and thankful that Representative Lemire included us in the discussions on this bill. We had very good cooperation and discussion and analyzing most, I think, of the problems when the bill was heard in the Ag Committee, and that was also a good experience. I also would like to comment to the members that while the Green Acre changes since 2008 have been stressful, painful, interesting over the last few years for assessors and property owners, and it did get a lot of feedback that many of you have heard, I really, as an assessor, think it was very helpful. Assessors statewide learned a lot We made a lot of changes when we reviewed each property within our counties. We corrected errors that had been going on for, in some cases, substantial amount of time, because we just didn't have the motivation or the reason to look at all of those individual parcels. And I think everyone has now done that. We made the changes that needed to be made to come into compliance with the intent and the letter of the Green Acre Law. So we corrected errors that had been made. I think that was a real plus, and it probably wouldn't have happened if this whole issue hadn't come forward. So progress was made. We support this House File 12 completely. We think it'll make life easier for our taxpayers and easier to understand. And we also are, we got the Green Acre provisions, we think, pretty much under control now, and really don't care to make a whole lot more changes to that law. So thank you for authoring this bill, and thank you for letting me testify today.
Thank you. And I think we may have a question. Representative Crawford.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Hagan, can you just explain for my benefit why we want to continue to have the two classifications?
Madam Chair, Representative Crawford, by two classifications, you mean the 2A and the 2B?
Correct. Yeah.
There's a lot of reasons, actually. I would argue and submit to you that as assessors, there should have always been a time when since the property tax is based on an ad valorem concept, tax according to value, assessors should have always been able to have a good record and be able to report how much land was tillable, productive land, how much land was woodland, how much land was swamplands, because arguably they would sell for different amounts. I think in some of the recent years, as land values were increasing so rapidly and double-digit inflation was hitting all the recreational properties, I think some assessors, and with the advent of CAMA systems, got a little sloppy in keeping the separation. And I think there was a point in time when the woodland was selling for basically the same as the tillable land. Particularly in the north two-thirds of the state, the recreational landowners and the hunters were competing with the farmers for the property. And consequently, I think they were in a position to buy, particularly in the northern two-thirds of the state where the fields are smaller and the woods are bigger. I think they oftentimes would buy the land for so much an acre if it was woodland fields, no matter what. The only differentiation that appeared to be found in the market was if it's swampland or upland. Consequently, some assessors quit breaking that out. I think that was a very big mistake. I think you have to be able to differentiate between tillable lands, woodlands, how they're used for classification purposes, which keeps the legislative options open, and for valuation purposes. I don't think the world that will always exist where woodlands and tillable lands sell for the same. So that's critical. There's also a real compelling reason for sales ratio purposes. If the assessors are unable to separate the 2A tillable productive lands from the 2B rural vacant lands, they can't identify the actual use of the land properly. And a lot of the properties that are selling for recreational purposes were going to the sales ratio study that the Department of Revenue conducts. Consequently, a lot of the recreational sales were driving up the sales ratio, and it was attributable to ag lands. And as an administrative agency, we were requiring assessors to raise the valuation of their farmland, oftentimes reflective of the sale of 2B properties. So I think it's critical from an assessment, down-the-ground assessment perspective, to have the two separate 2A and 2B for quality assessment.
Very good.
Representative Crawford? Okay. Any other questions of the witnesses? Representative Lateski?
Madam Chair, and thank you, Mr. Hagan, for being here. And I appreciate your testimony. You know, Mr. Hagan knows that most of what he just said is exactly what Representative Marquardt and Representative Coonan did and were criticized for. And I'm glad to see that folks have now come around on this, because let's be clear, this bill is not a repeal of what the previous legislature did. And I know a lot of people said and ran on that they would repeal it. This is not a repeal, as was just stated. It's partial repeal, and you've just talked about all the great things that changed due to this report that the author is keeping in the bill, and in fact members who did this and were roundly criticized for doing it. And now I'm glad to hear the assessors across the state understand that it was actually very good policy and that they've kind of gotten up to speed on that. You know, we did have a huge problem across the state, lots of sloppy work, outright some assessors were not even offering Green Acres in many counties. It was very unclear what was assessed how, and so that is the good work of the legislature that put all that in place. And you know, elections were won and lost on these provisions as people misunderstood them. And so now, just so members understand, much of the criticism that was people talked about is being retained in the bill. So that is not being repealed, and I agree with everything you said. But I do, Mr. Hagen, want to ask you, and I understand from the assessing standpoint and from the Department of Revenue for clarifying 2A and 2B, which was what Representative Coonan and Marquardt and Representative Demmer insisted upon, is that they created 2A and 2B. It didn't exist before. It was these folks here that came up with it that you've sung the praises of. So I understand, you know, let's have it clear so we can have better assessment practices and get everybody up to speed on their training and what they should be doing. You know, how though, in the Office of the Legislative Audit Report, you know, we still have this problem that is not addressed in this bill, that, you know, one of the big findings of the report was that the preservation of farmland effects were short-term and tenuous at best. And now, with Representative Loeffler tried to get the covenant back in the conservation plan, I mean, can you comment? I don't see that the legislature in this bill is doing a single thing to change the outcome of the Office of the Legislative Auditor, which said the program's effect on preserving farmland doesn't work. Can you comment on that piece, not the assessing piece, because there's a lot going on in this bill.
Mr. Hagen?
Madam Chair, Representative Lincheski, I agree, I guess, as a tax administrator with the Legislative Auditor's report. I don't think a three-year clawback has a material effect on whether it does not slow development. I think, as we've heard testimony over the years, as we've had this discussion on a long period of time, that at best it probably just enhances the bottom line of the person when they sell the property. You know, the rule preserve, you know, I might have lost your question a little bit in there. I apologize. The covenant, I believe the covenant was a good enhancement to keep lands in the covenant. I think it required the property owner to have a little more skin in the game, as we, in the vernacular, we talked of, where they had more of a commitment. Sadly, there was so much misunderstanding and miscommunication, and there was a lot of reasons for that, I think, between the 2008 original bill may have overreached some with a seven-year payback, and originally the rural preserve did not have a potential to go into any program. I think the creation of, as you know very well, the creation of the Rural Preserve in 2009 alleviated a lot of those problems and resolved a lot. And in my mind, I believe, as a sort of an administrator and a historian of property tax, I think if the 2009 changes had come before the 2008, and the 2008, you know, so you had the Rural Preserve in the 8-year covenant, I think things would have gone quite well. I believe the misinformation that got out there in the impossibility of honoring in the bill, I think the misinformation on the no rural vacant land could be in Green Acres or in the Rural Preserve didn't exist. I think that just created so much public misunderstanding among administrators and property owners that you just couldn't unring the bell and go back. So, and I think in a nutshell, the 2009 language was not bad, it was not flawed, but it was just so much sentiment, public sentiment against it, that it just was untenable.
Okay. Representative Lemire, then, did you want to proceed with other witnesses, or are we ready to take up some amendments?
We're ready for the amendments.
Okay. I'll take them in order.
Madam Chair, I do.
Oh, does anyone
have an oral amendment? Should I take care of that first, or should we?
All right. Yes.
And this was brought to me by Mr. Hines and Andrea Fish from the Department of Revenue. On page 2, line 16. I would like to delete classified and insert enrolled.
Did you say enrolled?
Enrolled,
okay.
Yes.
Is that it then?
That would be it.
All right. Representative Lemire, do you want to just explain then what you're doing here?
Mr. Hines, would you like to?
Mr. Hines?
Madam Chair, this is just a technical correction that Ms. Fish from the department and I came up with. Green Acres isn't really a classification. It's a program that you enroll in, and it just was a better word, we thought.
Okay. Any other discussion? Seeing none, all in favor of the technical amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign? Okay. Passed. Are there folks that want to offer an amendment? I know we have several at the desk. Okay. Representative Doubt.
Madam Chair, I have one amendment that I'd like to offer.
And that is which number?
It's A21. I don't believe you have it yet.
The page will hand out the amendment. Representative Doubt offers the A21 amendment.
Basically, I believe this is kind of a technical amendment. I think that there was probably an oversight in the drafting of the bill that property that was 2B that would go into the Rural Preserve Program, there was some language that said it needed to be at least 10 acres. What this amendment does, and I think it's the original intent, is that it does not need to be 10 acres as long as it's adjacent to at least 10 acres of 2A, or productive land. So I guess in the real world, this would be maybe somebody that has a 40-acre farm and 35 acres of it is productive and 5 acres is not. That 5 acres would not be eligible unless it was at least 10 acres, and I think that doesn't meet the original intent. I've talked to the author, and I think he agrees with this and thinks it's a good idea. So,
all right. Representative Lemire, have you any comments then?
Yes, I would support this amendment, Madam Chair.
Did anyone ever, you know, we probably need a little discussion. Any questions about the amendment? Representative Markworth?
Madam Chair, I guess I'm just wondering what the current law says if someone from staff could, or Mr. Hagen from the department, just so we know that's the intent and what the current law is, and I want to make sure this isn't a major change here.
Right. Mr. Hagen.
Madam Chair, Representative Markworth, I'm not, my understanding is under current law, if you had a parcel of property that was less than 10 acres that was adjacent to 2A agricultural property, it would, under current law, qualify for green acres.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so, Mr. Hines?
Madam Chair, just to tell Mr. Hagen, this is regarding rural preserves.
Oh.
This amendment deals with rural preserves, which does have a 10-acre requirement right now.
Madam Chair, my apologies. I was on a green acres track, but if it is rural preserve, it would require a 10-acre minimum, I believe.
Representative Lucheski?
Thank you, Madam Chair. To the author of the amendment, I guess I'm trying to understand this then. So if you have non-productive land, we're talking about in 2B, so you're not farming it already. You want people to be able to get green acres for non-productive land and not even have 10 acres? Is that right? Just trying to understand the amendment.
Representative Dowd.
Madam Chair, Representative Lucheski, no, this is regarding the rural preserve, so it would qualify for it for the rural preserve.
Okay. Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It seems to me that a 10-acre farm is a pretty small farm, and so this would allow rural preserve next to 10 acres. I mean, I could see potentially a lot of suburban land potentially saying, oh, yeah, we're raising Christmas trees, and we've got a few of those planted on our 10 acres out back. And, I mean, I don't think that that's the intent necessarily, but I think this really takes it out of real substantial farms. But I stand to be corrected if there's someone who can demonstrate to me that 10 acres is a real farm in Minnesota and that someone can earn a self-sufficient living off of. That's really tiny.
Any comment, Mr. Hagen?
Madam Chair, Representative Loeffler, I could comment that to be eligible for rural preserve, you had to be properly enrolled in Green Acres in the past, or it had to be part of a farm ag homestead. So there would have to be an ag component there to make it to the baseline to qualify for the rural preserve program. I'm still trying to digest exactly what this would do, but you would have to have enough, which it's a pretty low bar, quite honestly, where you'd have to have 10 or more acres in production to qualify for the ag classification. And once you did that, you could, in fact, qualify for the rural preserve component.
So just to follow up, so Mr. Hagen, 10 acres is the minimum that we have currently in law? Mm-hmm. And do we have many farms that are that small?
Madam Chair, Representative Loeffler, I believe
Mr. Hagen.
10 acres is the minimum. And I think particularly in the north part of the state, you do find a fair amount of farms that are small, minimal acres, 10, 15, 20 acres. That are in fact classed as farm under statute.
Representative Loeffler?
Just one more follow-up. Can you envision my concern about suburban homes that really aren't earning their living off of their land using this as a way to reduce taxes?
Mr. Hagen?
Madam Chair, Representative Loeffler, that's a very legitimate concern. I believe in the metro area, very oftentimes the assessors are appropriately split-classing property, where if there's a real there's two predominant uses, an agricultural use and a residential use. They would break split class of property as provided for in statute, and that would alleviate that problem. So they really would not be eligible for the ag homestead. There'd be the residential homestead and the ag land would be a component of that, but it would not expand it into the rural preserve.
All right, any other questions? Representative Marquardt.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. You know, my big concern last week was the fact that we were, you know, sending a good and valuable program for farmers down a very uncertain and perilous road, you know, when we kind of removed the covenant, because one of the big things that were mentioned in the OLA report is that Green Acres was going to land that, you know, wasn't tillable and so forth. And so at least the covenant, I mean, we set up the rural preserve so you could continue to do that. So taking the covenant is one step away from that, and I see this as being another step away from that. And, you know, members, if you want to take the chance down the road that, you know, because I don't think we're taking the politics out of this. I mean, the fact that we are not addressing a major issue in this report, I think, is going to lend itself to more people who do not benefit from this plan coming back and saying, this is not, I don't have the confidence in it, and we're going to be back to square one. And so I think this amendment moves us further away and makes the path even more perilous than before. So that's my concern with this, Madam Chair.
Any other discussion? Ms. Pinky.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I would also just caution on whenever you move that bar that everyone now understands as being 10 acres, if that bar changes to less than 10 acres, whether it's for agricultural classification or the Green Acre Program and now the Rural Preserve Program, 10 acres has been something that is not subjective across the state. If you have 10 acres, you can then look at whether you qualify for ag classification or Green Acres or Rural Preserve. I see a potential slippery slope, and I recognize Representative Loeffler's concern as well, because to get into Ag Preserve, it has to be an agricultural homestead or formerly enrolled in Green Acres, and that's still a good thing. But without that 10-acre limit, I too see people that may want to get a tax benefit because they have 10 acres of woodland or swamp on their parcel, and it doesn't have to be out in a rural area either.
Representative Dowd, did you want to comment?
I did. I actually have a question as well. Thank you, Madam Chair. What this amendment does, first of all, just to clarify, somebody who has less than 10 acres by itself would not qualify. This would only allow someone that has less than 10 acres of 2B that is adjacent and under the same ownership of 10 acres or more of 2A. It would allow them into the rural preserve program. So I guess my question for you is what happens under my scenario where someone has a 40-acre farm with 35 acres of 2A that qualifies for Green Acres and 5 acres of wooded property that they would like to put into the rural preserve program?
Madam Chair and members, if I were talking with a taxpayer in that situation, I would likely suggest that they combine their 35-acre parcel and their 5-acre parcel into one parcel and make it 40 acres, and then that's a non-issue. I'm not sure if retaining that smaller parcel is simply to get a tax break and hold it for some potential future use. That could be a possibility, but in many cases, those parcels could be combined if they're contiguous.
Representative Dowd.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Pinky, that's not exactly my question. We're not talking about two different parcels. We're talking about one parcel with two different classifications, okay. A 2A okay. section and a 2B. You know, basically a productive 35 acres and a non-productive 5 acres.
Yeah. Right. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I guess I'd suggest working with the assessor and see if that 5-acre piece is practical to separate, or if it's not practical to separate, then it can be 2B that really qualifies for 2A because it's impractical to separate. And last year the law was clarified on that impractical to separate language, that if it's windbreaks or rock piles or ditches, that it would not change to the 2B, that it could still continue under the 2A. So,
Ms. Pinky, I think we have some clarification, or perhaps from Mr. Hines. Or
Madam Chair, Representative Ms. Pinky, just to clarify, if it's already been classified, though, as 2B, 2B cannot be enrolled in Green Acres. So, you know, I think that's the situation that Representative Dowd is trying to address, is if it's 2B and it can't go into Green Acres and it can't go into Rural Preserve, where does it go?
Madam Chair, if I might respond. I believe the department sent out a directive to assessors last year that if in the course of assigning Green Acres classification, Green Acres enrollment, that if the remaining parcel or the remaining acreage was less than 10 acres, that the so consequently didn't really have a landing place, that the assessor should properly class it as impractical to separate or determine it as impractical to separate, which would make it 2A in effect but would give it the benefits of Green Acres. So at the end of the day, it would have exactly the same benefits as your proposed bill would assign. And certainly we'd set out that directive, and we'd be more than happy to try to make certain all assessors are administered that way.
Representative Dowd?
Madam Chair, thank you. You're not getting to really the issue, though. This piece of property, in my scenario, has already been declared non-productive. It's a 2B. What I'm talking about is making it eligible for the Rural Preserve Program. It certainly can be 2B non-productive and be taxed at that rate. However, under this legislation, it would not qualify for the Rural Preserve Program. So I believe the intent here is that as long as someone owns at least 10 acres, and 10 acres of that qualifies for Green Acres, they can own, you know, whatever from there. But the area of their farm that is not 2A and productive should qualify for the Rural Preserve Program. That's what I believe the intent of the law is, or this proposed legislation. I think that the oversight was here that it specifically says you need at least 10 acres to go into the Rural Preserve Program. This just says you can do less than 10 acres as long as it's adjacent to 10 acres of 2A or Green Acres property. So I think you're missing this. In my scenario, the 5 acres is already 2B. It can be taxed at non-productive 2B rates, but it doesn't qualify for Rural Preserve. What I'm trying to do with this amendment is qualify it for Rural Preserve so that somebody who's farming a larger piece of property can have their non-productive property, regardless of the size, as long as it's adjacent to at least 10 acres, included in their in the Rural Preserve Program and taxed at the same rate. Mm-hmm. So your response didn't exactly answer my question. What happens if there's less than 10 acres of 2B? It's already been classified as 2B. What happens to that, and how do we get it in the Rural Preserve Program?
Mr. Hagan.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think we're sort of talking past each other. I apologize for my lack of clarity. If you had a property in your example of 35 acres of 2A and 5 acres of 2B, the land would be classed as, you know, be valued as tillable. The 35 acres would be tillable. The 5 acres would be rural vacant land. The current administration of the way we're administering, we'd say if it's less than a 10-acre remaining portion of a original property, so in your example, the 35 2A acres and the 5 acres of rural vacant land would be valued exactly the same because it's less than 10 acres and can't be rural preserved, the assessor should treat it as impractical to separate, which is sort of a catch-all for ditches, streams, creek bottoms, that sort of thing, or just small patches of woods. And that would be enrolled within the Green Acres, which would give it exactly the same benefits as Rural Preserve, exactly the same value. At the end of the day, it would be treated exactly the same as if it was in Rural Preserve, only it would be within Green Acres. The reason it would be in Green Acres would be determined to be impractical to separate because it was less than 10 acres and part of an agricultural Green Acres property.
Mm-hmm. Representative Dowd?
It sounds like you and I are trying to do the same thing. My question, and I think that what you're saying is not happening out in the real world. So that's why I'm trying to do this. So it sounds like we're trying to get to the same place in the end. So that's what my amendment is trying to do as well. I'm not sure that what you're saying is exactly happening, though.
Madam Chair, I believe we are talking about exactly the same thing. I'm maintaining the current law allows for it, and we can certainly step up our administration and make sure that it is being treated that way throughout the state, if that would be a solution.
Madam Chair and Representative, if I could weigh in a little bit. We're doing exactly what Mr. Hagen just described. If we have a 35-acre parcel that also has 5 acres of woods on that parcel, we have the 5 acres broken out, and we have two, I'll call it codes, which means nothing to most people here, but we have a code for 2B woods and 2A woods. If it's under 10 acres, the impractical to separate portion that's less than 10 acres is treated just like the 2A that's productive land. So we have it broken out. We are giving them green acres. Now, I can only speak for how we're doing it in Dakota County, so I don't know statewide, but Mr. Hagen could figure that out, I'm sure.
Well, Representative Dowd, it sounds like yours is a clarifying amendment. So if there is any other discussion on that? Seeing none, we'll proceed to the vote on A21. All in favor of A21 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, nay.
Nay.
The chairs have it, or the ayes have it, rather. Amendment passes. And we have the A16 amendment. Was somebody interested in offering that?
Madam
Senator
Chair,
Lincheski?
I have a number of amendments, but if I may, I wanted to move the A17 amendment.
All right. Senator Lincheski moves the A17 amendment. And do you want to explain your amendment, Representative?
Thank you. And trying to find it. Madam Chair, what I'm trying to do in the A17 amendment is ensure that due to this special preferential tax treatment in this part of Minnesota law and in Green Acres and in Rural Preserve, that all the other property taxpayers in the political subdivisions, whether it's township, county, city, are not going to pay an increased property tax due to the fact that others are going to get a tax break. So what the A17 amendment does, it requires that when the tax rates are calculated for Green Acres and Rural Preserves, they're done as if that the tax rates are in the tax base at full value. Then what it does is it freezes that limit so that the net effect is that the local units of government then receive that revenue, but they do not shift these tax breaks onto the homeowners in these districts, thereby ensuring no residents receive a tax increase. Now, the local units of government may not be happy about it because, you know, currently they're being held harmless. We're just shifting property taxes from farmers to homeowners. And what I'm doing is stopping the shift. That's what this amendment does. It makes clear that all these other folks who are going to get a tax cut are not going to be able to shift their property tax increases onto the homes. And that's the A17 mm-hmm. amendment.
Any discussion on the A17 amendment? Mr. Hines.
Madam Chair, Representative Lincheski, this may have been a drafting error on my part, but just so you're clear, right now as drafted, it's only dealing with rural preserves. Okay. But if we wanted to add Green Acres in, it would just be a simple amendment to do that. Would you like me to suggest mm-hmm. that language?
Representative Lincheski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, please, if you could direct staff to do it orally. I guess I thought I had it for both.
Mr.
I apologize.
Hines.
And I, Madam Chair, my apology. On lines 1.8 and 1.9, if we just said instead of under section 273.114, if we said sections 273.111 and 273.114, that would pick up both programs.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to incorporate that, if I may.
All right, Representative. The verbal amendment is incorporated to A17. Is there a discussion on this A17 amendment?
Madam Chair?
Yes,
Members,
Representative Lemire.
Representative Lincheski, wouldn't this leave the counties with less revenues?
Representative Lincheski?
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Lemire. Yes, it ensures that all the homeowners in all these districts aren't going to pay increased property taxes. That's part of the big concern in this program, is that it's a tax break that everybody else pays. It's hidden, and the legislature keeps doing it because it's not on the legislature's spreadsheet. It's a zero. If the state of Minnesota had to pay for this, had to give these farmers these tax cuts, there might be a different discussion, but legislators can sort of give somebody a preferential treatment and without on the record explain that what they're doing is raising homeowners' property taxes, and I want to make that clear. I know the next bill on the calendar today has dramatic revenue reductions for counties as well in the property tax freeze, and I'm making a clear choice that if we're going to give these tax breaks to folks, we should not stick it to everybody else in the process. And so, yes, the local units of government would have less revenue.
Representative Lemire, any comments?
I would recommend a no vote on this amendment,
okay.
Madam Chair.
Is there further discussion on the amended A-17? If not, we'll proceed to a vote. All in favor of the A-17 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
The amendment fails. All right, are there other folks that have an amendment at the desk?
Madam Chair.
Representative Lucheski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have the A-16 amendment, and Madam Chair, having just listened to that last vote, and I guess I could have done the roll call, and therefore everybody would know that folks were just willing to raise people's homeowners' property taxes, but I decided not to do the gotcha thing, but I would like a roll call on this, Madam Chair. The A-16 requires that since we're going to be okay with shifting everyone's, you know, letting some people pay other people's property taxes, this would just ensure that it would require that the property tax statement show that. It would show how much of the property tax is due to shifting from green acres in the rural preserve. And, for example, Madam Chair, we have this on the property tax statement now on market value credit. This just makes a transparent understanding for the people of Minnesota when they receive their property taxes. They should be able to see it, they're paying more in homeowner property taxes because of the existence of this program or less. And I think that way we'll have a little sunlight on this program, which is moving tax burdens around. And this would just add it to the property tax statement that all of Minnesota, when they get their forms, can see how much their property taxes are going up or down because of this tax shifting program.
Any discussion on the A-16? Representative Lemire, did you have a comment?
Madam Chair, members, I would also vote no on this amendment. It's singling out farmers, and it's going to be extra work for the counties, and we just don't need this.
Okay, any further discussion? Seeing none, we'll proceed to the vote. All in favor? Oh, we're going to have a roll call. Okay, we are going to do the roll call.
Okay, Chair Runbeck?
No.
Vice Chair Crawford?
No.
Representative Markwart?
No.
Representative Barrett?
No.
Representative Benson?
Yes.
Representative Doubt?
No.
Representative Detmer? Representative Dietrich?
Yes.
Representative Coonan?
No.
Representative Lemire?
No.
Representative Lucheski?
Yes.
Representative Loeffler?
Yes.
Representative Mahoney?
Yes.
Representative McDonald?
No.
Representative Peterson?
No.
Representative Wardlow?
No.
Representative Detmer?
With 10 ayes and, or 10 nays and 5 ayes, the amendment does not pass. Okay. And any other amendments, members? Okay. Seeing none, then we'll move to the vote. And any further discussion on the bill itself? House File 12 as amended. Okay. Seeing none, all in favor of House File 12 signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. All opposed? Same
no.
sign.
Nay.
No. Nay.
No.
The ayes have it. House File 12 passes and as amended and is referred to the Committee on Taxes. Great. Okay. Thank you, members.
Thank you, Madam
Appreciate
Chair,
your
members.
Work. Thank you, Representative Lemire. And let's see. We're going to move on to hear House File 481, and I'm going to ask, I'm going to make a presentation, and I'm going to ask Representative Crawford if he'll just sit at the front.
Excuse
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yep.
There are, I believe there's handouts going around. There's probably four or five different handouts, so I don't know if they're all distributed. Okay. Well, one is, of course, you would have the fiscal impact note. There is a house research simulation report that covers 3 years' worth of property tax information. There is a city unallotment report. Okay. Anyway, well, it's coming around, and so I'll probably proceed. But so, House File 481, what we're going to do today is hear testimony. I suspect that most people, because most people don't seem to like levy limits, but we're going to hear a lot of reasons why we can't do this and why it's not good. And I want to know why we can't do it. And I think we're going to have a chance to hear where this bill sort of fails taxpayers or fails the local units of government, either way. But 481 is brought because looking back over, 20 years, it's apparent to me we have in Minnesota, uniquely probably, too much government. We've got 1,736 towns, although this bill does not deal with towns at this point. We have 854 cities, we have 87 counties, and frankly hundreds of special taxing districts that complicate and add layers of spending to our property tax folks.
Excuse me, Representative Runbeck, do you want to move your amendment, your DE amendment?
Oh, thank you. Yes, I do have a delete all amendment. Really, it's just because it was simpler for folks than trying to correct a few things. So it's a delete all amendment that is virtually.
I don't think you've moved your bill yet.
Oh, I move House File 41, and we do have a delete all amendment that you should be looking at.
Representative Runbeck, where do you want to move the bill to?
We're going to move it to taxes. I think we're going to probably lay it over here and for further consideration in an omnibus bill.
Thank you.
Okay. All right.
So are you moving your amendment now?
I am moving the delete all amendment to House File 41.
Is there any discussion on moving that amendment? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries. Proceed.
All right, thank you. Well, we've had a lot of discussion already this fiscal year, and it appears to me that we've got sort of a situation of where an awful lot of people are focused on the revenue side and maybe not enough focus on the cost-cutting side. We're in a different era, it seems to me. We had the 90s where revenue was flowing freely. We've had generous state aid programs, and really we're talking about, ultimately, the role of the state in the $3 billion program of state aids and credits. But we need, frankly, a lot more work on the cost-cutting side when it comes to local units of government. And I want to thank those cities that have sent me, I did request information and feedback, and some have been very gracious to say, we are living within our means. We expected there would not be additional local government aid. We have built our budgets based on a flat local government aid. And we have to say thanks to those folks. And we know that there are people who just came off of city councils and are former mayors. And I'm not addressing any of you in particular. I think there are some very good decision makers here that have lived within their means in their local government. At the same time, there are plenty of governments around the state that I think need to be more considerate of the taxpaying public, and that's really who this bill addresses. But I look at it as more and more costs are being passed on at the property tax level. We've heard it again and again and again. Some new streams of spending have occurred in the last couple of years. We're now seeing some bonding that's being permitted at the local government level for soft costs, i.e. retiree benefits, unfunded pension liabilities, and so on. What that means is that we are putting out to the future costs we should be paying for today. We have local governments, local units of government that are not paying as they go, that are not living within their means, and are pushing these off on the property taxpayer. So, and I think it's become such, if we look at our property tax statements, I mean, how many lines, frankly, of spending are there? And it seems to be getting out of control. We have special taxing districts. We have, in some cases, a new line now for library spending. I think that's happening in Ramsey County. We have special fees and so on. And I'm bringing this bill because we keep hearing about local control. And I want to simply put it out here. Local control has become something of a fantasy. It works, you know, sometimes, and it doesn't work other times. But we seem to fling the idea out kind of when it's convenient. And when it serves our argument, we say, oh, local control. And when it doesn't, then, you know, we don't talk about it. But think about how we have really stripped local elected officials of power. The legislature has laid on them mandates. The legislature has laid on them maintenance of effort requirements. We've given them strings-attached money. We have imposed rules regarding wage negotiations, which means that the employer is not in charge of the wage picture. It is the employee who's in charge of the wage picture. We've got arbitration awards, such as the recent one in Edina, which you know, I think I handed out a piece about that. But, I mean, just examples of, you know, where local elected officials are really not in charge of the spending. And we have done that to them. We have stripped them of power. We've also got just simply the subsidy of local government aid, which is not imposing discipline on cities. It is, in fact, enabling cities to continue to spend. And we've heard from MTA, I see they're in the audience, but I appreciate their information where they've said that in an analysis, the LGA cities are spending more on discretionary kinds of city services as opposed to basic services. So I think the evidence is there that we've enabled some less than prudent, less than basic spending on services. So 41, you know, frankly, is not a solution. It is an antidote to what is going on. Nobody likes levy limits. This bill is actually a harsher, a stricter levy limit, let's just say. It does freeze property taxes at the 011 levels so that there is, you know, few opportunities, really, other than bonded indebtedness that, you know, will be allowed. And I'm going to suggest some reasons why we need it this year. First of all, I think, you know, case in point, levy limits work. So if you want to just look at Mr. Hines's, this is from him, but a report of 3 years' worth, starting back in pay 2007. If you look at what happened in that year from pay 2007 to 2008, statewide property taxes increased 7.8%. There were no levy limits in this particular year. So we had a 7.8% increase, and, you know, that's frankly unconscionable. That can't keep going on. In pay 208 to 209, there were levy limits, and it came down. Spending, property taxes came down to 5.9% increase. And then finally, in pay 09 to pay 010, with levy limits imposed, and, of course, with LGA unallotted, 2.1% is all that was raised at the state level, statewide property taxes. I think we just got the report from, I've just seen the LMC numbers for 010 to 011, and it's even lower. So it works. Levy limits do work, and they force some very important things. So we don't know at this point if LGA is going to be where it's going to come out at the end of this session in anticipation of the fact that there will be less or there'll be more. I think it's still important to say levy limits should be imposed. Frankly, if they are lifted, we've had two or three years of you know, restrained spending. And I've seen what happens around here with restrained spending. The spending entities do not think that this that the losses are permanent, and they will be anxious to recoup either salaries or just general spending. They're going to want to recoup the losses. We can't allow that, we have to say, come on, you got to keep going, folks. Redesign, contracting out for services, consolidation, so on and so forth is a very important task, and it didn't get all accomplished in the last 2 or 3 years with the freeze or the unallotments. Frankly, I think we all know, whether it's our homes or our businesses, cities, the same. The only way we start to reform, the only way we start to rethink how we're delivering services and how we can be more cost-effective, and in this case it really matters because it is taxpayers, it is really how Minnesota is going to be regarded as a home and as a place to do business. But we don't start thinking seriously until the money disappears. And so I'm just saying we must continue to keep down the path, and levy limits is the way to go. If it means that some cities who are sitting on some fund balances need to spend those, this is the time, so on and so forth. But the bottom line is we've spent a couple of decades really allowing government to grow. We've kind of enabled it. We've said, gee, local control, isn't that nice? They're going to do the right thing. Some do. Some really do the right thing. Others have raised levies because they can. Okay? It's easy at the city level. And the county level, frankly, to raise levies because you can. It's, citizens don't come to your door and do a lot of complaining. I know that. So it's time to maintain the discipline. Taxpayers are expecting it. We need more folks here, frankly, who are thinking about the bottom line impact on taxpayers. And that's, frankly, what this bill is about, is saving taxpayer money. So did I point out? Oh. Big point to make is House File 41 over 2 years does save $240 million to taxpayers. $240 million. And if you think about how that impacts your local businesses, who are probably $100 million of that, that's a sizable chunk of money in a time when we are not out of the recession, when we have to fear that local governments unleashing levy limits will try to recoup. This is the pattern and the habit. So I strongly encourage you to support this bill. Let me refer you also to another handout which shows that levying back, is sporadic. Yes, 50% of the cities are levying back the lost amounts. And, why? Some of them levied back 100% of what they thought they didn't, should have received in LGA. And others did not levy back a nickel. So we've got quite varying patterns, and important, I think, to note. And also just a piece about levy limits. They were a strategic part of what happened over the last couple of years, and they do work. So at this point, I think I have a couple of witnesses, and then I think most of the folks who like to testify are going to tell me why we can't and why it's wrong and why it... what are the hurdles? We know it's all about hurdles around here, but somebody's got to keep fighting for smaller government. We've got more than we can afford at this point. So,
can we take a little discussion? We have a question from Representative Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I represent the city of Minnetonka and also Plymouth, and both of those communities have been extremely frugal in their taxing and their spending, and have done a very excellent job. Minnehaha Creek runs a few blocks from my house. Lake Minnetonka, it's suggested, is going to have the potential for major flooding. So if we put this limit on my city, and they suddenly incur large expenses, hopefully to protect my house from flooding and my neighbors and portion of the city, aren't you, by passing this legislation, punishing my city for its frugality? And, I have to say, my hands are not clean on this, because I voted for the previous levy limits as well. So, but we all, as you say, talk about local government control, but and whether we want it or not. And it seems to me we're interested in it when it benefits our state budget bottom line, were not so interested in it when it doesn't.
Representative Benson, you know, I'm certain every single city is going to have the same, well, but what about this situation? Mm-hmm. You know, I think that there are emergency situations. Maybe the discussion today is about that there needs to be a pot of money available for true emergencies. And I don't know what the situation at Minnetonka is, but I think there's plenty of other. I mean, I think there, from the state auditor's report, you only get a piece of the picture. So I'm thinking too that there are many different sources of funding that are coming into our cities. In fact, there were $7 billion of stimulus funds, if I'm not mistaken. So there's money around. I'm not sure that it's necessarily in the general fund or that it needs to be. And I would just leave it at that, but we'll hear from others as to how we might handle emergency situations, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm. Representative Bennett Benson.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Runbeck, you mentioned that we should think about the bottom line impact to taxpayers, and I totally agree that that's something we need to think about. But one of the things we've talked about in this committee and in the LGA work group is how when cities, because of the pressures of levy limits and responding to whatever unique circumstances they have increasingly turned to fees, special assessments for things that used to be covered by the property tax. And that's really hurt our low-income, fixed-income seniors and others in applying for the property tax refund because they are not able to have those increased fees in any way recognized in the PTI program, and they're also not able to deduct it against their federal income taxes. And I think that our property tax system has, and our PTR program were designed to address issues of affordability, and I think that if this were to be enacted, we would see even more cities and counties turning to increased use of fees, special assessments, and other things for basic services because they may have to deal with things like this year's record snowfall. Some of these years in which you indicate that, you know, levies didn't go up as much, in part that was because we had mild winters, and that gave cities a little bit of a cushion that they could use for other unexpected costs. And so I am concerned that by taking away the levy as a way to respond to legitimate needs, we're going to be forcing more communities consider things that outside of the property tax base, which I think will disproportionately fall on our seniors, people on fixed incomes, people with disabilities, and really kind of upset the ability of the PTR to really help those people. And I wonder to what degree you've thought about that.
Representative Rehnquist.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Loeffler. I mean, you always have good points. That's a very good point. And I think it's, you know, one we need to consider. And I don't know that this bill solves it. Maybe there's a way that we can come up with, you know, some approach that would help solve that.
Representative Loeffler. Representative Detmer.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Runbeck, is it looking through the bill, let's say, Representative Benson pointed out, if there is an emergency situation, the local taxing authority, may they raise the additional levy if approved by the voters?
Well, absolutely.
Representative Runbeck.
Mr. Chair and Representative Detmer. The allowance for a referendum, of course, is always there, and you may not have the timing available in an emergency situation, but certainly one thing I think we do need to rely on more is the use of voter approved spending by cities.
Representative Detmer, any further questions? You want to invite your supporters and have them introduce themselves and who they represent.
I know I have former Representative Phil Krinke with the Taxpayers League would like to testify.
Thank you. Please identify yourself for the committee and who you represent.
Good morning, members. Phil Krinke with the Taxpayers League of Minnesota. Spent a few years around the table and have spent many, many more years dogging the issue of property taxes, one that is always difficult, one that is always challenging, whether you're in local government or whether you're in state government, an issue that always is before the legislature and always a lot of debate and a lot of controversy about how we go about dealing with property taxes. This, ladies and ladies and gentlemen, I have always felt that the idea of levy limits is a blunt instrument which falls on the just and the unjust, and is never a quote-unquote total solution. But what you have in front of you today is a very difficult time for homeowners, probably the most difficult time that homeowners have faced in the last quarter century, maybe in the last 50 years. Property values are dropping dramatically. I don't think anyone would argue that, or anyone can show evidence contrary to the fact. In fact, recent information says Twin City property values fell in the last quarter of 2010 by over 12%. Recently, I heard a comment of a CEO of a major Twin City bank that indicated that they believed that foreclosures would top in 2011 would top the foreclosures that happened in 2010. So I think that the people around the state of Minnesota are looking to you and what you are going to do in response to the situation of rapidly declining property values and more people who are seeing their mortgages go underwater. This, as I said, ladies and gentlemen, is obviously a difficult choice and a blunt instrument, but it has results which property owners will see and recognize as leadership on your part. The situation of current, I think anyone who's looked in knows about property tax caps or levy limits understands that the levy limit that was put in place 2 years ago works, is porous and doesn't work very well. What Representative Runbeck has before you today is a much more stringent, much more hard line in terms of property tax increases. So I would certainly support this legislation, not because that it is the best tool, but I think it is probably one of the only tools that is available to the legislature. I found it outrageous that Governor Dayton, in his explanation of a veto of legislation reducing the budget, said that it was a property tax increase. A total distortion, ladies and gentlemen, of the facts. There is no piece of legislation that in reducing state budget is going to directly and automatically result in a property tax increase. You very well know that those property tax decisions are made by individual taxing jurisdictions and individual elected citizens across this state. There is no quid pro quo in reducing or increasing state government aids. There are past performances. We all know that when you go to buy any type of an equity, the people selling you those equities say past performance is no indication of future results. So what your actions here today regarding either reducing local government aid, leaving local government aid in place, or other budgetary actions are going to result in direct property tax increases or decreases for that matter. So for you to, or anyone, let alone the governor, to say that that legislation was a direct property tax increase is an outright distortion. Again, many things in this bill that can be worked on, many things that may need refining and may need further attention. But as I said, I think the citizens of the state of Minnesota are looking to you to help them in what is a dire and very dramatic time in terms of property values and in terms of property taxes. I would stand for any questions that the members might have.
Thank you, Mr. Finke. Chair. Any questions? Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and former Representative Krinke. I think sometimes in this committee we sometimes have to balance what our when we're talking about taxing jurisdictions, we're talking about all of them, and this would apply to counties as well as cities. And since most of the services that counties deliver are actually mandated in Health and Human Services and Community Corrections, and because of the economic issues that you just identified, more people losing jobs, it's not just foreclosures. It's also they're applying for medical assistance, emergency aid. We're seeing typically in you when you have a tough economy, you have more people who unfortunately turn to crime, trying to make the rent or the mortgage payment. And so at a time when we're actually under economic stress is when the demand for mandated services within counties goes up. And I do think we do put county boards in a situation of do they raise property taxes to support their obligation under state law to take every application and give it fair due consideration and to supervise every person who the courts put on probation or community oversight, or do they ignore the state law that gives those mandated responsibilities? And I think we need to have a transparent and honest discussion about that, because I think that's where we do put county boards in this circumstance. And if you'd be willing to address that, I'd appreciate it.
Mr. Krinke.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Loeffler. The situation obviously is always a difficult one in terms of what is mandated by this legislature, what's mandated by state government, and the duties and responsibilities those local elected officials have to their citizens. So the discussion is often had. I don't think there's a legislative session where there hasn't been an outcry of local government officials about mandates. But by the same token, I know that my county commissioner often complained about mandates, yet failed to ever come to me with one mandate that he wanted repealed. So I think thou dost protest too much. Local government officials always come and say, oh, the mandates, but as soon as the legislature works to alleviate or remove a mandate, they obviously then hear from city and county officials across the state and others about, oh my goodness, don't remove that mandate, or that mandate serves as an equalizer, or that mandate protects certain constituencies. So, yes, I understand that the state puts a tremendous amount of burden, particularly in the area of delivery of health and human services, on county, on the counties. But as you also know, this legislature has also talked about and considered either consolidation of counties, some other streamlining of the delivery system. So, again, I'm not a great big fan of levy limits. I never introduced a levy limit bill while I was in the legislature. But again, these are challenging and difficult times. The levy limit that's in place is so porous that it doesn't work. So, and when you have a governor who says that a budget reduction bill, a reduction in local government aid, is a automatic property tax increase, what's the response from the legislature? I know my friend Representative Marquardt believes in that concept, believes what the governor said, but there's no actual proof that that's the situation. Because again, there are cities that have lost substantial amounts of local government aid that haven't increased their levies, and there are cities who didn't ever receive local government aid that increased their levies just under the mere guise that there was a reduction in state aid. So again, it cuts both ways. We're going to have this discussion every time the legislature gets together. But the question is, what are you going to do for your constituents in the upcoming situation of decreasing property values and increasing levies?
Before we continue, I want to tell the committee members, we have a lot of people that like to testify in this, both supporters and opponents. We want to try and keep our questions short. We have a list of about three right now. Representative Loeffler, do you have a...
Well, Mr. Chair, I'd just like to say I don't think We have chosen to have a partnership in the delivery of essential services in Minnesota, and it's a choice that Minnesota has historically made to have some services delivered at the local level through counties in partnership with the state. Other states do it with 100% state workers. But to say that because county commissioners have not come here and begged us to say we should not put people on supervised parole or that we should not serve a senior who has used up their life savings and still has tremendous health care costs and see whether or not they would be eligible for the medical assistance program, to me is, I think, disingenuous. I think both of us will step up to serve those people as both. And so I think we need to just deal with the realities. And if you want to bring a bill forward to shift those responsibilities, then we can take that into serious consideration. But if we're going to look at what the pressure is to raise levy limits, to raise levies, but we need to, you know, in response, I think we have to have an honest look at what's going on and the pressures on those local governments and what will be the reaction to passage of this legislation. And I think we do need to consider the impact on mandated services and what our expectations are.
Mr. Kroenke. Representative Barrett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a picture in my mind of this issue as it relates to a property tax payer. I kind of liken it to Adrian Peterson going around the right end at the 30-yard line, going into the clear and heading for a touchdown. I can imagine people on TV right now are going, yes, 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 we got to do it. From a property tax perspective, why wouldn't they? So I and those are the people that I represent. So I'm inherently inclined to support this bill, but I do have a few thoughts on it, and I'll try to make them brief. I have a couple county commissioners here who represent my county. They happen to be here for the Green Acres issue, but they were surprised, I think, as they mentioned, that we are discussing this. I represent a county who has done a very good job of last year they had a zero levy. Of course, it didn't affect everyone evenly. The business property taxpayers had an increase, and the residential had a decrease, so we still didn't make still wasn't satisfactory for a large group of my constituents. But they did balance their budget effectively based on the needs of their county and the feedback they got from their property taxpayers. They also have mandates. The 100 megahertz radio system that was put into place, a federal mandate, was extremely expensive for many rural counties. And so they have that mandate. They blended that mandate into their budget and have been able to make do. But they've been doing, trying very hard for the last two, 3 years to balance their budget. But my issue, and this is probably a question for Mr. Kroenke, is related to cities like, well, Minneapolis, for example. There was a Star Tribune report that they had to increase their budget by 6% because of unfunded liabilities related to long-term pension costs. And those are the issues that I'm quite frankly concerned about, that we're not making hard decisions, that across the board, not every county and city are making those hard decisions. So I'd like to get Mr. Kroenke's comments on that situation and how important that is as it relates to this bill, that we have a process in place where cities are mandated to make that hard decision, such as Minneapolis.
Mr. Kroenke.
Well, again, as I stated earlier, Representative, that you have, as I said, this is a blunt instrument. It's difficult times. Difficult times call for very tough choices. Said never supported the idea or introduced legislation that would have put a levy limit in place because I always felt that these issues should have been put to the voters. This legislation contains a voter approval of any levy increase. So if it is a situation, whether it's Minneapolis, whether it's a county challenged by potential flooding, if it's a county that or a jurisdiction that faces an unusual circumstance because of state mandated requirements, whether they be in the area of delivery of health and human services or public safety, there is the option for any jurisdiction to go to the voters and say, we have an unusual circumstance, we have a situation that other cities, counties, or other taxing jurisdictions don't face, therefore we need your approval for a levy increase.
Representative Barrett.
Thank you.
Representative Marquardt.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I didn't know if I wanted to go down this road again. Chair Kroenke and I have debated this several times, but you know, to say that since 2003 that $1.7 billion in cuts and aids and credits to cities and counties did not drive up property taxes is beyond belief. But I can see why you do it. I mean, like House File 130, when you can pass a bill that cuts $500 million to aids and credits, to say it's not going to have any consequences makes it easy because you can solve your budget deficit and say it's not going to have any consequence. So I understand why you do that. But if you look at what's put out by both Governor Dayton and former Governor Plenty, whether or not it was revenue estimates, they put that right in there. Levies will increase by this much. If you look at the tax incident report that comes out every 2 years, there's a part in there that says state aids and that put upward pressure on property taxes under Governor Plenty. If you look at the Voss data report under the Department of Revenue under Governor Plenty, talks again about how aids impact property taxes. So you can go against conventional wisdom and say what we do here, you know, so you can solve a budget. I mean, that's nice. Let's cut a billion to education. Just say they can handle it. It's not going to, you know, I mean, so to say that, you know, and I'm sure you got your data and I can give mine, and, you know, I wish you'd go out and talk to the cities in rural Minnesota and some of those who I've seen firsthand how they deal with this. And Representative Runbeck, the part here on the unallotment, I see 52% of the unallotments were levied back. I happen to see local government as partners with us. So I see this as a glass half full in the fact that cities and counties like the rest of us are recognizing that after $3.3 billion of property tax increases in the last 8 years and folks in recession and so forth, they're being very responsible, realizing, you know what? We just can't raise these property taxes. So instead of just looking at that as a levy limit influence, I see that as governments being partners with us. Remember, our local units of government provide the services to our citizens that you and I represent on the most personal level, law enforcement, plowing the streets, you know, sewer and water and all these things that we don't do as a state. Who would do that? So I like to look at us being a partner, and so I guess to just say that everything we do here do not have consequences, I guess, you know, you can, I know Representative Krinke, you're going to stick with that and you're going to, your story, but it just, it's beyond belief. And if you get out there and talk to folks in rural Minnesota, and I know around the state, they'll give you a little different picture of what's actually happening.
Mr. Krinke.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Marquardt, yes, we've talked about this many, many hours and had many, many discussions. I'm not saying that there aren't consequences. Certainly there are consequences for local governments in whatever the legislature does, whether it be from mandated programs, such things as comparable worth, PELRA, as Representative Loeffler was mentioning, you know, mandated delivery of health and human services. So, of course, there are consequences. But as you well know as anyone here, that approximately 50% of the citizens of Minnesota do not live in communities that receive local government aid. So for someone to say because of a reduction in local government aid that there are going to be, emphatically going to be, property tax increases is what I'm saying is an unfair and undocumented statement, Representative Marquardt. You can certainly say that in communities that receive local government aid that there will likely be a property tax increase. That, yes, you can certainly show that there's statistical information to document that. But to go out and, as I said, unfairly represent across the state that you're going to see property tax increases because of reductions in aid. And again, ladies and gentlemen, if you haven't taken the time to study, there are other states who have a great deal more latitude with regard to local taxation, sales tax and other revenues than the state of Minnesota. Minnesota is a state which favors state aids rather than local taxing jurisdiction options. So Yes, if one of the things that if you want to open up local jurisdictions to increase taxation or tax options, that's another way to go rather than aid. But that is a slippery slope as well, as then you see counties and cities competing in terms of which taxation and which local taxes they want to increase. But if you want local control, well, then let cities and counties have a great deal more flexibility with regard to imposition of local sales taxes, local payroll taxes, and other entities other things in terms of local taxation. But there's no question Minnesota is a high aid state. And again, there are consequences, obviously, for everything that is done here at the state capitol.
Representative Marquardt.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Runbeck.
To some of the other testimony.
I have one other, and then we'll go to the other supporters. Representative Dietrich.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just have a really quick technical type question. So, and both of you at the table have much longer, a longer, richer history in property tax policy and legislation and finance than I have. So I hope that this isn't too naive of a question. So what your bill does is it freezes the property taxes to what they were in 2010, correct?
Right.
Okay. So for as I was just looking at some of these runs and some of the information I'm looking at, we all do, my city, and I see... if I recall correctly, they reduced actually property taxes in 2010, and then they did not levy back any of the unallotment money. So this freezes their property tax level at a very low level, I would say. Would you agree with that?
Representative Runbeck.
Representative Dietrich, you know, I hope we're getting into a mindset where we need to think about property taxes being a smaller and smaller, you know, a smaller burden as opposed to an ever-increasing burden. So the fact that they have a lower rate is, frankly, in my view, on the right path. We need to think about where we can permanently reduce spending.
Representative Dietrich.
And I would agree with that, but the way that I am interpreting this is this punishes people who are on the right path. And that is very frustrating to me, especially because I think of my city also is going to have to deal with flooding. We already dealt with some substandard snow removal policies in order to keep costs down. You know, we did not compete with the other cities. And then I look at these cities surrounding my city, and they are very different than my city. They have a different cultural makeup, different issues with crime, different issues with the ability to raise taxes, and so I see them treated very differently. Then they will have the ability to tax more because they did utilize every tool that they had in 2010, and now my city, who did not utilize every single one of those tools in 2010 and had the good behaviors, are now going to be punished in my opinion at a different level. But I'm going to continue to listen to the testimony. I still have not concluded anything. I'm just trying to help clarify for my own purposes.
Representative Runbeck.
Thank you very much. I don't know if Ms. Dalton had any comment to that. I think that's really what it is, though. And it would apply to special taxing districts as well. I mean, so it is, you know, it is across the board. And so, again, what I think it offers is opportunity to do some creative redesign, some creative partnerships, some new way of thinking, you know, and I think that's an important product of working with fewer dollars.
Representative Dietrich.
No, just that I would not disagree with anything, and my city is already engaged in all of those things. They're trying cooperatives, and they're trying, a greater... You know, I just, when you say that, I just don't want anybody listening to this presuming that cities don't already do that, because I'm very closely linked to my city. I grew up there, and I do know exactly, not exactly, but a lot of what they do. And so I just don't want to presume that they are not doing those things.
Right. And I think we need to give a lot of credit to those cities that really have. I mean, in the last few years, the kinds of things that have happened in cities, I think, is case in point of why it's a very healthy, you know, activity. you know.
Representative Dietrich?
And that, just to that point, and that's why I wish we weren't punishing the cities that have good behaviors. I wish that you would have taken this as more of a targeted approach. If there are problems, solve them. Don't punish everybody with the same instrument.
Representative Runbeck?
Well, I'll just point you back to, you know, unfortunately, when there are no limits, then we see some unfortunate and, you know, really unconscionable increases, you know, across the board anyway. So,
Representative Dietrich?
No, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Krinke.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, committee members.
Do you have any other supporters?
I believe I have a gentleman, maybe two. Actually,
please come down to the committee and welcome to the committee, and please state your name and who you represent for the record.
I'm Chris Broberg, and I'm a Minneapolis property taxpayer.
Mr. Broberg,
who
thank
I
you for coming.
Hope to represent, because it is clearly not represented in this room. And that's a perspective I'd like to bring just listening. This wasn't originally what I was going to talk about, but there's such great angst and concern here for the city's budgets and the city's things. I've lived in Minneapolis 14 years, and the one thing I've experienced there is the miracle of compound taxation. That is, in 14 years, my taxes have quadrupled. Okay, my neighbors, I have a lady down the street, senior citizen, had her house paid for 25 years ago. Right now, her entire savings has been used up, and her entire Social Security check goes to paying property taxes in the city. And her payment each year is almost the price of her house, the original purchase price of her house. Another guy down the block, his father purchased his house in 1964 for $26,000, an expensive house then. Right now he pays $26,000 a year in property taxes. If this bill doesn't happen to freeze property taxes, in two more years at the current rate increases they're projecting in my city, I will be paying the equivalent on a monthly basis of my original mortgage payment on my house and property taxes. So, you know, you guys can sit here and say, oh, it's, you're punishing my city because we're being responsible and we can't raise taxes. Well, you know what? You're not going to be able to raise taxes anymore. It's just not going to happen. It doesn't even matter. You can give them all the freedom they want. You're just going to crush, at least in Minneapolis, you're just going to completely crush the city, because who can possibly afford to live in a city where you're paying more in property taxes than in mortgage payment? And it's already happening, if you haven't noticed, in Minneapolis. There's something like 26% unoccupied homes in certain parts of the city. It's more than that. I think, and she wanted to talk about why I think this is possible. And I just grabbed a little thing on the city budget from 2010 just to do a little bit of research. And, you know, and I saw an article in the paper today in Minneapolis. They're cutting some fire stuff. And they always talk about cutting police and fire. And I assume that most of what the city did was, you know, just police and fire, you know, and maybe some road repair and snow plowing. Well, I looked at the city budget. Police and fire make up 14% of the city budget of Minneapolis. And we act like that's the only possible thing we can cut. There's another department in here that I know a little bit about, and it's a 7% of the budget. And frankly, if you completely eliminated that department, nobody in Minneapolis would notice, except for maybe the city councilmen and some developers that are their buddies. Okay, and the city would actually be a nicer place to live. It's city planning and economic development, 7% of the budget. They take the LGA you give them. I've heard this. I haven't confirmed it. Almost a third of the LGA you give them, they put right into this department. That is just a complete waste of money. Even when you break down by property taxes, where property taxes go, police and fire only make up 25% of the budget, or 28%. Public works is 23% of the total budget. It's 5% of what comes out of property taxes, because I believe it's largely funded by fees. That year, the pensions were 9%. Other departments are 23%. There are some that they have departments that are redundant with state departments. I think it's Civil and Human Rights Department. City Health Department. They've recently started fire inspections on all properties. I know a little bit about this.
Excuse me, Mr. Broberger. We'll give you about two more minutes.
Oh, that's okay. Plenty.
Okay.
That's plenty. Thank you. they've started these fire inspections, and I wasn't aware that there was a big, huge problem in Minneapolis burning. And they've started these, and I believe that's a burden not only on the property tax owners, the burden on the city, because they're, you know, it's got to cost money. They're not charging us to be inspected. So, and I don't suggest that they do, by the way. Thank you. But anyway, I just want you guys to just think about this. It isn't about you know, the cities, I mean, they're going to have to do with less because they have to, because everyone has to, because they're already maxing out the property taxes. I want to stay in the city. I'm going to stay as long as I can afford it. But seriously, I mean, what we have all to look forward to if we stay in our house long enough, and this is the concept of ownership. People are paying, if they stay in their house for 50 years, you're probably going to be paying the purchase price of your house every year in property taxes, and the city can take away your house if you don't pay it. Where's some ownership? This is like a very immoral tax, I think, and you know, maybe if cities need to rake their residents for property tax, maybe they can do it, or, you know, for taxes and dollars, maybe they can do it in a little better way.
Thank you, Mr.
I don't think we need to enable them.
Thank you, Mr. Boberg, for your impassioned testimony. Representative Mahoney.
Well, Mr. Chair, and to the witness, I wholeheartedly agree that Minneapolis should get rid of its Economic Development Committee. I think it'd be the best thing for St. Paul and the whole East Metro ever happen.
Okay.
I would love that. Because you see, the economic development, just say, give you a sense that Minneapolis is probably the biggest economic engine of the state, and their economic development has brought more jobs and more income to the city of Minneapolis than anything we've ever given. And I have gently tried to nudge that back a little bit to the pluses for other areas. I never seem to win that battle. But and to go on to the fire inspection, primarily that's fee-driven. And if you want to get rid of fire inspections in the city of Minneapolis, go after it, because you will empty the city within years. Within a couple of years, property taxes really won't matter. People will leave.
Mr. Broberg.
Just one thing, the fire inspections for... They started them, I don't know, what, two, three years ago, and before that, they never did them. Okay, just one thing. Okay, and to the other thing on the Economic Development Department, if they would concentrate on having some reasonable property taxes, they could just let economic development happen rather than force it. What they use it for, and this is my big concern with that, is it's to feather their nest. You know, it's interesting, the things people never talk about cutting, because that's where they derive their power. You know, they go to developers and they pick and choose who's the winners and losers in the city for economic development. I mean, they've done great things. I mean, Blocky and Gavaday Common. I mean, this is great economic development for the city that's all going bankrupt. I mean, it's ridiculous that you think that that's
okay,
actually real economic development.
We're
going to
cut it off now. I don't know if you have anything else, Representative Mahoney. Thank you, Mr. Broberg. Do you have anybody else?
One more gentleman. Oh, I'm sorry.
You want to come back to the table, Mr. Broberg? We have a couple more questions, I guess. Representative Barrett.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to thank Mr. Froberg for coming in. You're a property taxpayer. That's who you represent, the common folks. That's who we should be representing and are representing in our jobs here. Just wanted to thank you. You come into a situation where we have thoughts. Certainly, there are different thoughts, and come up, and you're up to the challenge. And so thank you for doing that, taking away maybe from your job today to come down to let us know what you think. Thank you very much.
Mr. Broberg.
Sure.
Okay, thank you again. Representative Runbeck, any other supporters?
Mr. Chair, I do have one additional
comment. Please come on down. Welcome to the committee. Identify yourself and who you represent, please.
I'm Scott Pekarik. I'm a resident of Minneapolis. And like Chris, I think I represent the taxpayer here in Minnesota. I'll try to keep my comments brief.
Thank you.
I've never been involved in politics, first time at the state capitol. This property tax issue was the main driver for getting me passionate about local and state politics. Last year when I received my property tax statement, opened the envelope, and after I picked myself off the floor, after the shock that I was put in, I decided this was time to maybe start paying attention to what's going on. This year, my property tax levy, my increase, was 18.1%. I thought my fees were already high at almost $10,000 a year for a three-bedroom house with no garage, no off-street parking, and unfinished basement. But when they went to $11,300, almost $1,000 a month, I realized that this is time that maybe we need to stand up and start addressing these issues. We talk about The city of Minneapolis has a budget of approximately $1.3 billion. I got to believe that somewhere in $1.3 billion, there's got to be something that the city of Minneapolis can cut. So when we talk about putting, you know, limits on the levy increases, and we talk about, you know, consequences. I mean, I think a consequence that our elected officials, our council members, our city officials have to start looking at is they're there and they have a fiduciary responsibility to solve these problems. The average the council member in Minneapolis makes $70,000. The mayor makes over $100,000. Okay, so you're telling me 13 council members and a mayor, each with their own staff, cannot figure these problems out, and someone like me has to take time off from work and go down to countless meetings at my neighborhood group, the city, the county, and then here today at the state to try to figure these problems out? I mean, the simple fact is we as taxpayers can't afford this. I do not have a well of money that is unlimited that I can draw from. And I look at these taxes as being almost parasitic, where sooner or later you're going to kill the host. I mean, even a good parasite knows that you got to keep the host alive. And what's going to happen in Minneapolis is, you know, I'm going to leave. I just can't. If I'm looking at another 18% increase next year, I mean, that's preposterous. That's another $2,000. And, you know, to illustrate my point, I brought $1,700 down to show the city that this is real money.
Mr. Picard, I could kind of wrap it up if you can.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
We're running short of time.
All right. Well, anyway, I understand there's consequences of every decision you make, but you know what? We're adults. We have high-paid people in most, definitely in my city, who should be able to figure out how to, you know, keep their budget at $1.3 billion. I think they can figure out another solution. So, thank you.
Thank you very much. We're going to, if the members will be patient for a moment, we'll take a question. And then we have the state auditor, Ms. Otto, here. She'll address us. Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you to the citizen testifiers in particular. I want to make a statement to Representative Marquardt. I listened to your impassioned speech on the House floor on House File 130, and to a lot of the members on the other side of the aisle. That is that if you accept the premise that the state is directly responsible for increases in property taxes by way of aid reductions, and you passionately oppose aid reductions on those grounds, then you have an obligation to support this bill. Because you accept the responsibility for property taxes, and therefore you have a responsibility to protect the taxpayers, and that's all I have to say.
Okay, thank you. Representative McDonald has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a brief comment, because I know we're running against time. I want to compliment the two taxpayers who represented Minneapolis, and if you haven't visited your city council, those who you may or may not have voted for, I passionately encourage you to do so, because you're right when you say that in a budget of whatever you said, $1.some billion, that there must be some room for some cuts in the city of Minneapolis. But have you, if you two and the rest of the taxpayers so passionately get involved in your councils and visit them and share with them your concerns in a group, without hesitation, I would guarantee that those that you elect would listen to you and be responsible for their spending and their taxing. So, and if they're not, then you vote them out and put in other responsible folks, such as maybe you two, for city council. But anyway, good work, and this is what our great democracy is about. We love to see our citizens come and speak to us as a former mayor and give us their concerns. That's what truth in taxation is very important. You know, for 10 years of the truth in taxation at the city of Delano, seldom would people come down and visit us. Roger, you could probably witness to that. But that is the meeting in which we approve our levies, and that's your opportunity to say, all right, McDonald, no more taxes, quit the spending, and so on and so forth.
Thank you, Representative McDonald. Representative,
are you cutting me off, Roger?
Marquardt. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, and I said it, I would be short. And I also want to thank those property owners who came forward. Back in 07, we had a property tax comment line. And I've got the book if you want to see it. There's over 800 responses from citizens around the state talking about how property taxes were hurting them. And for 4 years, we proposed property tax relief bills, one after another, with no success with the past governor. So this is not something new. And I can bring the book the next time with the 800 folks who saw property taxes as a huge problem. And unfortunately, we did not get the support to push through the property tax relief that was very necessary.
Thank you, Representative. I'd like to welcome our state auditor, Ms. Otto, here today, and please proceed. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Rebecca Otto, the state auditor. I, too, am a taxpayer. Representative Runbeck and members, I wanted to very quickly, because I'm sure there's more that would like to testify, just to cover one section of the bill that came to our attention yesterday as an office. The Office of the State Auditor oversees over 3,000 units of local government. We also oversee Volunteer Fire Relief Association pension funds. So basically in Minnesota, we largely have a volunteer system of firefighting, and to support that, we have these pension funds. In Section 7 of the bill, there is it's about pension liabilities. This mentions local police or fire relief associations. I want to give you a really quick 30,000-foot view. This may create some significant problems, and I just wanted to bring it to your attention. These pension funds have about three ways of revenues coming in. They get fire state aid, they get required municipal contributions some years if they're required, and then there's interest earnings on investments, okay? And then the money that goes out would be your benefit payments and expenses, basically. What this does is when communities are required to make municipal contributions, and there was one city that was required to make a $2 million contribution recently, they have to levy for it and collect the funds to give to the fire reliefs. If the city does not do that, the fire relief has to go to the county, and the county has to spread it across the tax levy. So there's really no option in terms of this not being paid. When our office reviews these volunteer fire relief associations to make sure they're investing properly, they've done all the work they're supposed to do, they get their audits, if they haven't done something or if they haven't received their required municipal contribution, we will not certify them for fire state aid. That's kind of the stick. You have to follow all the rules and then you get your money, which is a good system. And so if they're not able to levy for, if their amount is going to be greater than the 2011 level in 12 or 13, we will not certify them for fire state aid. So the pool of money that comes in, again, to fund these pensions, our volunteer system, which is very efficient, is fire state aid, municipal contributions, and investment earnings. It's really a triple whammy. If they don't get their fire state aid and or a required municipal contribution, they also lose opportunity to invest the money and get investment earnings, and that tends to be a significant portion of their revenues. So I wanted to bring it to your attention as the oversight office to let you know that it could have a significant impact on that system, and I would hate to see Minnesota go to a more expensive system. The impact on the taxpayers, the property taxpayers, your funding level line starts to decrease, and in order to get it to go back up, it's going to be a much steeper line, and it will actually cost taxpayers quite a bit more because you're losing out on the opportunity to receive investment earnings or gains.
Thank you, Madam Auditor. Ms. Dalton, do you have a comment?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I would want to also point out Section 5, which has a freeze on local match requirements. So as long as the local government is levying what they levied in the previous year, the state may not withhold any funds. So that would actually supersede the ability for to withhold the municipal fire aid.
Thank you. And thank you, Madam Auditor. We're going to have to clear out of the room. I don't know exactly what we're going to do. We'll send a message out to you as far as what we're going to do on this bill. Meeting adjourned.